Welcome to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon, and I'm here to reflect on a week when a cloud of violence passed over Atlanta and the world and kind of darkened the celebration here around the Olympics. But there's good news in this. Most people chose to be part of a solution and did not capitulate to the fear that came with a bomb. The sunshine of hope came right back out, and as luck would have it, this week's Paula Gordon Show welcomes Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who is the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the Centers for Disease Control here in Atlanta. He joined Bill Russell and me at the Commerce Club several weeks ago in downtown to talk about what we can do about violence, not just episodic, peculiar stuff, but violence in America. Let me give you a preview. A, prevention, not reaction. B, apply observable science and make it objective. And C, bring lots of people together with talent to challenge violence. He calls this a public health approach. So stay with us for an hour of good news about violence. Coming up, The Paula Gordon Show. Stay tuned. America has a reputation in the world at large, and among those of us who live here, of being a violent nation. That is not a trivial part of our history, and it's an important part of our presence. Dr. Rosenberg, how do we begin to get a toehold on how important violence is, and how do we begin to rethink the role of violence in a society that is trying to get better?
Well, I think first we have to move from thinking about violence as a representation of evil in the world and get more specific and start talking about very specific types of violence and break it down into specific types. We talk, for example, about youth violence. We talk about family violence, and family violence could be broken down further into child abuse, into domestic violence, partner, family and intimate violence, or elder abuse. All of those could be part of family violence. Or we could talk about self-directed violence, suicide, and suicide attempts, something we forget about a lot. Or we could talk about rape and sexual assault. The point is there are a lot of specific types of violence. And once we get specific, we can start to define it. And once you can define it, you can get a handle on it. For example, we define violence as the use of force with the intent to harm either oneself or another person or a group, plain and simple. But defining it lets you start to look at it and understand it in ways that we never thought possible before. And once you can understand it and define it, you can start to look at the patterns, you can look at the causes, and you can start to understand what works to change it.
You're an epidemiologist, among other things. I'm hearing you describe what sounds like an epidemiologist talking about a disease.
I think not so much a disease, but about a problem. I think when we talk about it as a disease, we kind of medicalize it, and we don't intend to do that. We don't think that violence is a problem with a medical cause. We don't think there's a germ that causes violence. We don't think it's a result of a specific biological defect. But it is a problem, so that we can use a public health approach, and I would differentiate public health from medical, but a public health approach to this problem and start to solve it.
Okay, what is a public health approach? As you've given me a sense of the medicine, your book, Violence in America, A Public Health Approach. Most of us don't think about public health. What is that distinction?
I would say it's characterized by three things. The first is that in public health, we focus on prevention. We try to change the way people look at the problem from one where you have to react after it happens. For example, finding the person who committed the murder, putting them in jail, punishing them, removing them from society. What we want to do is have people think about what could you do to keep that person from committing that murder before it ever happens.
Quite a different approach.
I think it's a total paradigm shift. It's a drastically different way of viewing the problem of violence. If you look at domestic violence, for example, the way people have viewed it is what we need to do is provide shelters for battered women. Right. We would not disagree with that. We need shelters. We need many more shelters than we have. But shelters are not enough. What we want to do is put shelters out of business. We want to prevent it from happening in the first place, and that's the shift in the way we view it. So when we talk about prevention, we're talking about something that complements the current approach, something that complements the criminal justice approach, and something that complements the approach of providing services to victims. We want to keep them from being victims in the first place.
You said public health had three-legged stool, and you gave me one, and then I interrupted you. So what are the other two?
The second is that it's based on science.
Ah.
We think that we can apply the same type of scientific methods, ask the same type of scientific questions that have been asked about other public health problems, whether they be things like smallpox or polio, whether they be things like chronic diseases, heart disease, smoking, or even motor vehicle crashes. But we can ask those same simple questions. That's what we would call the scientific method. It's really very simple. We're not talking about a highfalutin rocket science engineering here. We're talking about asking four simple questions, and this would define our scientific approach. The first question is, what's the problem? And what we do is we ask the reporters questions: who, what, where, when, how. We ask those questions. We look at not just one case, but 10 cases or 100 cases, be they domestic violence or youth violence or suicide. Look at 100, 1,000, 10,000 cases, but look for the patterns. Mm-hmm. When you understand who, what, when, under what circumstances did it happen, you can see the pattern. So that's the first question we ask. What's the problem? Describe it. In public health, we call this public health surveillance, gathering your data about the problem. The second question we ask is why. Why did it happen? Why this kid, of all kids, why was this kid shot on the street? Of all women, why was this woman battered? Of all men, why did this young man commit suicide? But the question of why, what puts them at risk? What's the role of alcohol and drugs? What's the role of poverty? What's the role of lack of education? What's the role of access to weapons? But why? What are the risk factors? That's the second question. The third question we come to after we look at the patterns and we look at the causes, and then we ask the third question, okay, if we understand the patterns and we understand the causes, question number three, what works? Think what might make a difference, and then go test it out. Look at interventions that might solve this problem and evaluate them. That's very important.
What works?
What works? The third question. So now we have three of the four questions. What's the problem? Why? What's the cause? What works to prevent it? And the fourth question is, how do you do it? Okay, let's say that you find out.
How do you do the what works?
How do you implement this solution? And let's say you find that teaching young kids social skills, ways to negotiate rather than ways to fight. Let's say you find that teaching young kids when they're 3, 4, and 5 is going to make a big difference. How do you actually get that put into place? How do you get parents and schools, groups, communities to adopt that and start to support that kind of intervention? So that's the fourth question. How do you do it?
So you've taken me from this big, fearful mass that is violence to a place where you can pick out pieces and begin to do something.
Exactly. And I think what this does is not only does it bring a fruitful approach that we have found so far has been extraordinarily productive, but it brings hope.
Not very much of that in the world today.
Certainly not with this problem. Yeah. I think our biggest enemy here, and a friend of mine, Bill Foege, a former director of CDC, says today that the biggest problem in the world today is not violence. The biggest problem is not infectious diseases, and it's not poverty. The biggest problem in the world today is fatalism. Is this sense...
Good for him.
The sense that you can't change things, that you just have to accept it the way it is. And when people combine fatalism with a fear of violence, what they do is they go inside and they lock the doors, they retreat and become depressed, then withdrawn, paranoid, hostile. It's very much in the wrong direction. And what we think that you can bring, if you let people know that these are solvable problems, you can bring a sense of hope to this problem of violence and get people re-involved, to bring people out of their doorways, out of their homes, into the communities to actually do something about it.
Of those four, if you take the four items that you talked about and apply that to violence, and also I'm curious how what the epidemiological tie-in to that is. I'm not sure that epidemiological is a word that is, just rolls off the tongue. How do those two come together?
The asking the questions and the epidemiology?
Yep.
Epidemiology, basically, to simplify a long word, just means looking at the patterns in a population. Looking at a disease in a lot of people, looking at a health problem among a lot of people. That's epidemiology. It looks at large groups, and it looks for patterns to understand the patterns.
That's real consistent with lots of work done at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, yes?
Absolutely. This has been a traditional strength of CDC. It was not developing a brand new type of vaccine that made the difference in smallpox, but it was looking at these patterns that helped the world to eradicate smallpox. Again, it was Bill Foege, who was in India and saw that we were never, ever going to be able to vaccinate everyone in the world, and the old approach wouldn't work. But he looked at the patterns of spread, and what he saw was that there, in truth, were only a limited, finite number of villages that had cases of smallpox. He understood how it spread, the patterns of dissemination, and what he said is, let's go and contain these outbreaks that we know are occurring. Let's focus down on those villages that have active cases. Let's keep everyone there. Let's immunize everyone there. And if anyone has been there and left, we'll track them down and we'll immunize those people. This was the containment theory based on understanding patterns. And it was that approach, the epidemiologic analysis, surveillance, gathering the data and looking at the patterns, that led to the eradication for the first time in the history of the earth of a disease.
So what I'm hearing you say is that by the application of science, a scientific approach, which is collecting the data, analyzing the data, beginning to see the patterns based on substantive information, you were able to, or he was able to, or you are now able to identify certain, for want of a better word, choke points, key points where you can,
I'm not sure I'd call them choke points. In talking about violence prevention,
we all perhaps need to address some of our vocabulary too.
Certain key places where I think where the application of resources can be maximized,
or what we would say is where you can find interventions that work and that are cost effective.
We are talking with Mark Rosenberg, who is an MD doctor. He has an MPP. We'll talk about that when we come back. That is a master's in public policy, I'll bet.
Mm-hmm.
He is the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We're all used to calling that the CDC right here in Atlanta. This is the Paula Gordon Show, and we'll be right back. We are back with Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who directs the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC here in Atlanta. We were talking about epidemiology, which sounds boring, and we're talking about violence. And you said that we no longer have to be fatalistic about violence. We can begin to address some of these subjects scientifically and do some things. And you had more to say on that subject, so I will let you.
I think sometimes the word epidemiology gets dry and doesn't have meaning, but if we can apply it to a couple of very specific examples, I think it would be enlightening. One example is the area of suicide. We started applying epidemiology to suicide in about 1983, and people said, gee, if you look at the suicide rates, they're flat. You're not going to find out anything interesting here. They haven't changed. They're not going to change. Why don't you go spend your time on something productive, at least something interesting? We said, well, let's look just a little bit at the pattern. So we looked at this flat line, these rates that didn't change, and we broke it down by age group. When we did that, we found something amazing. We found, yes, the overall rates hadn't changed, but the rates among older people had gone way down for a very long period of time, and the rates among younger people had more than tripled.
So it was a flat line, but within that flat line, there was great variation.
Yes.
And you wouldn't have seen it if you hadn't gone looking in the particulars, would you?
You never would have noticed it.
Yeah.
And when we did notice it, what really alarmed us were these epidemic rates among young people.
Now, there's the hook. Epidemiology breaks down to epidemic, and we can start hearing that, can't we?
I think we can. An epidemic means more than the expected number of cases.
Yeah.
And this wasn't just double the number of cases. This was triple the number of cases anyone would have expected. But the suicide rates among young people between the 1950s and the 1980s had more than tripled, and people hadn't looked at them, and they hadn't noticed it. Mm. All they'd seen was the flat line. When we start to look at these rates among young people, it had very, very important implications for prevention. For example, when I was in medical school, I was taught that the way you prevent suicide is by working in your office and looking for the high-risk group. That was older, depressed men.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that these men were depressed because they had retired from their jobs. They were no longer working. They might have lost a spouse. They might have lost their health. And they were depressed. But when they came into your office, you would notice that they were depressed and you could treat their depression. And by treating their depression, a big risk factor for suicide, you could prevent their suicide. Well, now that we saw that they were kids who were committing suicide, we start to look at these kids. And what research by Dr. David Schaffer at Columbia showed was that most of the kids who were committing suicide were not depressed. They were kids who might have other psychiatric problems. They were kids with drug abuse problems, with other alcohol problems, kids who were impulsive, kids who were in trouble, kids who were in trouble at home, kids who were in trouble at school, kids who were in trouble with the law. Not only were these kids not depressed, they were not going to doctors.
Oh, boy.
And in fact, the last patient that a child psychiatrist wanted to see was a young kid who he'd have to go get out of jail to bring to his office, and who might come to his office with a gun.
Yeah.
So these were kids who were not going to be prevented from committing suicide if we just relayed on the older methods.
Yeah.
So the implication for this was that, my gosh, we have a problem on our hands, and we have to relook at this set of kids for the risk factors, and we have to start looking very hard at what interventions would work. How could you reach them? What would make a difference?
And this is not an abstraction. I don't know anybody who doesn't know a youngster who's killed themselves. And it affects the whole community. It isn't just sad in the family. It has all kinds of very specific implications for all of us, doesn't it?
Oh, tremendous implications. You know, what greater threat to any of us than to lose our children?
Yeah.
I think that's the greatest threat.
Yeah.
And it's a threat that for a long time we didn't perceive and then didn't respond to.
And are too scared to talk about it, and it's embarrassing. And who wants to talk about kids killing themselves after all?
Well, it was also in these... And the statistics was hidden. It was flat, you know, we had a flat line.
Mm-hmm.
What you're describing sounds like a dynamic situation. Our sense is that once we fix a problem, it stays fixed. And if you looked at just the flat line without going behind that, it appeared that we hadn't exactly fixed it, but at least it had stabilized. And it wasn't at least going to get any worse, and so many things were getting worse around us. Then why should we worry about that? And what you're describing is a much more dynamic and fluid and chaotic set of circumstances.
It's kind of like when you come out of a bright room at night and you go outside and you look up at the sky and all you see is blackness. And if you take that one quick fleeting glance, it looks rather boring. It's all the same blackness with lack of light. If you stay outside for a few minutes, you start to see patterns that are pretty spectacular, of stars, of planets. Not only is there not nothingness, but there's more out there than we can conceive of. I think as you start to look at a lot of these parts of violence, it's the same way. It becomes such a rich palette that gives you so many places to try to change things, so many places to intervene, and so many more ways to understand the pattern. One of the things that came to our attention once we started looking at suicide among young people was people started seeing clusters. They started seeing clusters of cases. And people at first said, well, there's just more suicide among youth. So it's just a statistical expectancy that some of these will be clustered in the same place around the same time. It doesn't mean that they were related. Nobody got called to go to Plano, Texas, because within a very short period of time, there were 8 suicides among young people. And some people felt that this was too many, too tightly associated to be left to chance. We went down, we investigated that cluster, and it looked like it was not just chance, and it looked like it might actually be some sort of contagion, that the suicide among one susceptible youth might actually trigger suicides in others. There might be some element of just putting the idea into one's head. There was an element of imitation. And we did go down, we looked at that cluster, we looked at other clusters, and then it became clear that this was a very real phenomenon. I guess the most.
And it infects the same way that other infectious agents do. You catch it.
It spreads. Exactly. Yeah. This notion of contagion, you know, whether it's interpersonal violence and crime or suicide, there are a lot of ways that it's spread in our society. So we looked at these clusters. The most tragic one was about 15 young men on the Wind River Navajo Indian Reservation out west within a very short period of time in a very, very small population of only about 5,000 people. It became clear that the phenomenon was real, that you could understand the phenomenon, that you could intervene, and that you could actually do some things after the first suicide to prevent subsequent ones, and that a community could be prepared and you could make a difference. And I guess in a sense, when you ask why even start to study the phenomenon, why spend your time looking at the stars in the sky or the statistics behind the straight line, ultimately what drives us is the notion that you can make a difference, that you can save lives and that you can save young lives. I'll tell you a story. I went to the movies one night and I was watching a very long movie. It was a movie, Shoah, about Holocaust survivors and the Holocaust. And it was very long, and all of a sudden I started to hear my name over the loudspeaker. Mark Rosenberg, please come to the snack bar. So I said, I better wake up. I'm falling asleep. I'm at the movies. It's long, but I can stay awake. About 30 seconds later, Mark Rosenberg, please come to the snack bar. I got up and walked back, prepared to have them think I was crazy. No, we don't page people in a movie, but they had called me. Someone had called from my child's school, because I had given a talk there just about 2 months earlier on this phenomenon of suicide among young people and the way it was spread and the way that there could be clusters and the importance of intervening once there was the first suicide. And what had happened, it was just a week before graduation, and a young person from the class had committed suicide. All the teachers had come together. They were meeting with a headmaster, and they had called me. They said, we're all together. We're doing what you said to do. Be proactive. Intervene. Could you come here and talk to us and help us plot our strategy?
Right now.
Now.
Yeah.
Now.
Now.
Well, it was a slow movie.
Well, I never saw the end, but I did go there and met with the teachers.
But it is also beautiful that out of a story of death, you could bring life.
And life at risk, because there were a lot of kids at the school who really looked up to this young man, and it was a very tragic death. But as we started to understand his death, we did very systematically go through a set of steps. We tried to say, okay, who are the kids at highest risk? How can we provide some help for them? How can we identify them? Who are the resources? How can we let people know without glorifying this death? And how can we save some lives? People were very scared because this was a greatly admired kid. We actually made it through the graduation with no more suicides. But I think it really shows why we intervened.
The doctor in you must have been very pleased.
Scared for a while.
Yeah.
And ultimately pleased.
Yeah. Well, you promised me a three-legged stool, and I took you off in other places. There is a third leg as we look at public health and violence. And we will be back shortly to talk further with Dr. Mark Rosenberg. And rather than getting you halfway in and then breaking away, let us break now and come back shortly to pick up on that third element. Dr. Mark Rosenberg is our guest. He is the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in Atlanta. I am Paula Gordon. This is The Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell is with me, and we will be right back. We are back with Mark Rosenberg, who is an MD doctor and has a master's in public policy. And I'm going to let you give us the third leg of the public health stool. I'll sit quietly. I will.
The third leg is what we call integrative leadership. And it means reaching out to different disciplines, that this problem of violence is not going to be solved by any one discipline. It's not going to be solved just by the public health community, but it's going to be public health professionals, epidemiologists working with sociologists and anthropologists, engineers, teachers, criminologists, judges, counselors, social service workers.
This sounds like a community you're talking about.
It becomes a community. It takes a village. It takes a world. You know, to raise a child, it takes a world.
Or to raise a society, apparently.
Mm-hmm. Or to solve a problem.
Yeah.
But I think it's this notion of teamwork,
yeah,
that there is no one group that has the answer, but there's so much richness in approaches from different disciplines that we can start to draw them together so that our team at CDC that works on violence now includes anthropologists, psychiatrists, psychologists, sociologists, criminologists, communications specialists, public health advisors. It's a multidisciplinary team, and different fields have a lot to contribute. I think the same notion of the simple word, probably for integrated leadership, is teamwork.
There you go. Thank you for bringing that into English.
Pulling together a team of people also means that you don't just take your solutions from one group or from one side.
Well, and you want a halfback and a fullback and a center and all those things I don't know very much about in football.
Diversity.
You need
you draw your strength
do
from
things.
Diversity, diverse disciplines, diverse parts of the political spectrum. And I guess in violence, this is one thing that I think has really impeded progress, and that is that people have thought that either you have to get your solutions from the liberals, and the truth is that liberals have some very silly ideas that just don't work. And conservatives have some very good ideas that probably will work. In the same way, liberals have some good ideas that we should take, and conservatives have some ideas that are not going to work. And the test of whether you accept an idea should not be where it comes from, but whether or not it works.
And you have a way to get outside of the wrangling and say, let's put some science to this. Let's put some calm, quiet, thoughtful, testable premises.
We tend to speak of science as if it is reliable. There are a lot of people that don't believe in science. There are a lot of people, I think, that would argue that science is what got us into this mess rather than what's going to get us out of it. More broadly, you're describing an extraordinarily complex process. We are accustomed, I think, to very simple rules of cause and effect. If you do this, then something happens.
You can predict what it'll be.
And you can predict with some high level of certainty what it'll be. If we raise prison sentences, crime will go down. Three strikes and you're out will solve the problem. Take guns off the street and the problem will go away. Put guns on the street and the problem will go away. But that the our approach and what we look for, and unfortunately the political debate seems to reinforce this, is that there is a simple answer, that the simple cause, do a thing and something else will happen. What you're describing is much more complicated than that, and I'm curious, particularly looking at that third leg, what can a community do to bring all that together? Where's the leadership? How is
well,
it
exactly.
How does it work?
We are sitting in the Commerce Club in Atlanta, a place that has prided itself over 35 years for having a position of leadership. And a lot of people are saying, how can I'll follow, just lead me. Is that part of what you're doing?
I don't know if we're just trying to get a group of followers. So I think we're trying to get a group of people who are involved, who open their minds, who are committed, who want to participate in the solution, because I think ultimately these solutions have to come from communities of people. I think another part of what we call part of this integrative leadership is the notion that it's not either or. violence is a complex phenomenon with complex causes, it ain't gonna have a simple solution. There is no simple solution. There's no unitary thing that you can do to solve all the problems. In fact, it's not even just one type of violence we're talking about. We're talking about youth suicide. We're talking about elderly suicide. We're talking about rape. We're talking about youth violence. We're talking about domestic violence. We're talking about child abuse. We're talking about elder abuse. It's not one problem, and it's not one solution. That's not to say that there aren't links among these different types and common threads, but there's no one simple answer to all of this. Some of the answers that people have proposed, we can pretty well reject. We know that they're not going to work or that they're not going to be sufficient in and of themselves. For example, the notion that all you need are more prisons and put more people in jail. We have more people in jail today than we've ever had in the history of the nation. Probably in the history of the earth, we have more people in jail. And yet among youth, the homicide rates are as high as they have ever been. And criminologists have told us time and time again, there is no clear correlation between building more jails and reducing the crime rate. It's not connected.
But it's politically expedient.
It's become politically saleable to say the answer is invest more in concrete walls and prisons and lock them up for longer and longer because people are afraid.
They're afraid, yeah.
In truth, you need prisons. There are people who ought to be in prison, and that's one part of the solution, and we don't want to reject that out of hand. The mistake is to think that that's the whole answer, because it's not. You're going to need different components to the answer. That's one of the things that's coming clear as we start to look at what works in the area of youth violence. It's very much like the notion of a balanced diet. You know, apples are good for you, but you can't subsist on apples alone, even though they have a lot of essential nutrients and vitamins and they're low in calories, high in fiber. By themselves, it's not enough. The same thing, there's probably no one food group and there's no one type of solution to the problem of violence that by and in itself is going to be the answer. But that's not bad news. I think what we need to do is to stop thinking it's either or. It's either prisons or education. It's both. It's not an either or answer. And that's part of what we mean by this integrated leadership too.
Well, you just triggered maybe a dozen different major public policy debate subjects in our nation, in our world, because we touch so many different ways across the planet. I'll bet you're not popular in some of those places, are you? This is not the way we typically go into solving public policy, where we want to do it fast, simple, easy, and then go on to the next election.
I think what we're trying to change is the way we make some of the decisions by using science. And science doesn't provide you instantaneous answers. It takes a while to understand. One of my regrets is that we didn't start looking at this problem of violence 20 years ago or 30 years ago when we started applying science to how we get a man on the moon. Mm-hmm. If we had put some resources into this question of violence, I think we'd be much further ahead.
And this isn't just a Sunday school question, is it? This has all kinds of economic and political and social implications well beyond just it would be nice if people didn't shoot each other.
I think there's no aspect of our lives that's not touched by violence. No matter where you live in this country today, I think our lives are all impoverished by violence and by fear and the threats under which we live. So I think it is a problem that touches all of us. Again, I think there's an example of a tremendous advance that was made. And that's, if you look at another part of the injury problem, that's motor vehicle injuries. Mm-hmm. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people felt too many people were being murdered on the highways. And they said, let's start to apply science here. And they put a few $100 million into the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And they brought about a miracle. A miracle.
It was seatbelts, wasn't it?
It wasn't one thing,
yeah.
Paula.
See? Okay, see, I'm still stuck. Help me with this.
All of us have that tendency to jump to one thing. But what they did was that they thoroughly re-engineered the automobile.
Yeah.
We grew up learning to drive cars where the steering wheel would impale us and the front end, the engine block would crush us like an anvil. They redesigned it so that now the steering columns collapse, the front end absorbs the impact and crushes like an accordion, and
you do have seat belts.
And you have airbags and side impact.
Yeah. We're about to take a break, but I want to... You're not suggesting that science is the answer. I think what you are saying is that it is science and the other things that are going on. That this is, as you were saying about the others, it needs both and, not one or the other. This is not just a challenge for science. It's a challenge for the community for which science has something to which science has something to contribute.
And we will be back shortly with Dr. Mark Rosenberg, who will have a chance to respond to that comment from Bill Russell. Dr. Rosenberg is the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the CDC. And we will be back shortly with the Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is here with me, and so is Dr. Mark Rosenberg. We are at the Commerce Club in downtown Atlanta, and I'm going to confess in public I am a hope monger. I think it's important. I also think that I need to know what I can do about things. So I would solicit from you, Dr. Rosenberg, as we look at violence, we're going to kind of get into the nitty-gritty. What can we do in a city like Atlanta? What can I do on Tuesday that begins to address violence in America?
Just a word about your hope-mongering, Paula. You ought to keep it up.
Oh, good.
Because in his book, Emotional Intelligence, Daniel Goleman talks about what's the most important quality for success. They looked at insurance salesmen. The most important factor for determining success was optimism. That was the most important thing, the sense that you could do it, that you could make a difference, you could change things the next day and go and get that sale that you didn't get today. That's
so
the most important factor in success.
Do some more of that optimism thing. Mm-hmm. Not a bad idea, Doc.
More of it. No, Molly Ivins said she's optimistic to the point of idiocy. So I think all of us, that is very important, the sense that we can do something.
And what is it that we can do as a city, as a person?
I think there's a whole range of things, and we're starting to look at these to get much more specific data about works, but I would divide what you can do for youth violence, for example, into four different categories. The first category deals with things that make a difference on an individual's own beliefs and attitudes, and these have to do with education and teaching. Starting when kids are very young, you can teach them social skills. When they're 3 years old, you can teach the kid on the playground that when someone pushes you off the swing, you don't have to walk away. Walk to the edge and pick up a rock, a very big rock, and come down and smash that kid on the head, there's an alternative. You can say, hey, that's my swing. A simple social skill, something that simple and that clear cut can make a difference. And then as the kids get older, still within this first category, you can teach them mentoring. You can have peer mentors. You can teach them nonviolent conflict resolution skills. You can teach them self-esteem. You can teach them how to deal with emotional crises. You can teach them how to deal with emotions. And you can teach them how to talk, especially boys. Teach them how to talk. So as men, they'll have words as part of their armamentarium. Mm-hmm. So there are things that you can do on the individual level there that are very important.
That sounds like it's real soft stuff, but this you're saying is important?
Oh, it's not soft whatsoever. It's not soft. And in fact, what we've tried to do is we're now working with communities in 14 different places around the country to look at some of these interventions, look at social skills, look at mentoring, look at nonviolent conflict resolution courses, and put them into a scientifically evaluable framework. Mm-hmm. Work with a community mentoring program so that you can actually measure with scientists and scientific precision whether or not it makes a difference. So what we're trying to do is take them out of the realm of soft, touchy-feely stuff and actually measure them, that step, the scientific step of seeing if it works. So you can measure them and you can do them and you can replicate them and you can make a difference.
Number two.
Number two is a category of changing immediate peer groups or family group relations so that when we talk about TV and the pernicious influence of TV and the bad effects of abandoning our kids to TV, what we can do may not be to alter the media, but what we can do is to stop abandoning our kids to the TV.
Oh, so I can't blame TV. I got to take responsibility for me and my kids?
Absolutely.
Oh, gee, that's harder.
Well, TV's gotten a bad rap. It's very easy to blame TV as the pernicious influence on your kids, when probably the much more important deficit is our abandoning them and letting them sit in front of the TV mm-hmm. for 6 hours a day, or worse yet, teaching them what we don't want them to learn. Most of the kids that we talk to about violence tell us that they first were exposed to violence in their homes mm-hmm. where they see a father beat a mother, or a father beat a child, or a father beat them. That's the dangerous exposure. But we can strengthen the family.
And that happens in every home, in every strata of homes in America. That is not restricted to any one class or socioeconomic group.
It happens throughout. Yeah. It happens throughout. And sometimes the highest socioeconomic status groups are the most guilty of abandoning their children. Yeah. Why? Well, we can afford it.
Yeah.
They can't afford it, but they live under the misapprehension that they can pay for it, but not afford it.
They'll pay for it.
They will. We all will.
Yeah.
But that's the second group, looking at peer groups, family interactions. The third group is looking at the larger social and economic environment, but trying to change the social environment. And this would include things like poverty, mm-hmm. education, jobs, job training. These are factors that the criminologists have told us for years are at the root of violence. It's not race that causes high rates. It's not ethnicity, but it's these social and economic factors. And if among racial groups you control for socioeconomic status, the rates of violence come out almost exactly the same. But what it means now is that we can actually start to look, what is the impact of poverty and education and jobs on violence ultimately? And if we can intervene, we can change it. We can give people jobs. We can combat racism and sexism. We can give people job training. We can give them hope for a job. We can give them hope itself. This is the social context. That's the third area where we can intervene and make a difference. The fourth area is intervening on the physical environment. Those things in the physical environment that kids are exposed to, things like alcohol and other drugs, things like decaying neighborhoods that breed fear, where they can't walk safely to and from school, or things like access to weapons. Those aspects of the physical environment we can also impact on and change those. In each of these categories.
So cleaning up the neighborhood may look like a simple thing, but it really might impact violence.
Absolutely. It looks like there's some very big effects that are achievable by reducing the access of kids to drugs, by reducing the access of kids to alcohol, and by reducing the access of kids to weapons. You can make a big difference. We get back to that question about surveillance and patterns. Why do it? Well, when we started looking at youth violence in this country, one of the patterns that jumped out at us was that kids were not fighting a whole lot more. But what had changed was the lethality of the encounter.
So when they fought, they hurt each other more or killed each other?
They killed each other.
Yeah.
They didn't fight more, but they fought more violently, and mm-hmm. the deaths were much more frequent outcomes, whereas it used to be a bloody nose and a black eye. Now it was a dead kid.
Oh, boy.
The other thing that jumped out was that the age of the victims had started to go down and down, and the age of the perpetrators had started to go down and down. So what we had for the first time was kids killing kids, and kids were killing kids increasingly more frequently with guns. They had access to weapons, easy access to weapons. This was part of the pattern that jumped out, but what it suggests is that perhaps by focusing on getting weapons out of kids' hands, not talking about anything about the adults, but focusing on kids and getting weapons away from the kids, you might be able to impact on the consequences of this youth violence. I think, again, it's a message of hope that we can understand the problem. Again, when you talk about youth violence, some people are hopeless. They want to give up
and
run away.
If they see a young person, especially a young black person, they're scared and they go the other way, they freeze or
I'm very scared,
and
but
that
I think
it doesn't have to be so.
It doesn't. We can start to understand it, and again, understand there's an array of interventions that can make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I want to translate this, if we can, into what I'm familiar with. We work with companies, and in implementing change, we talk about it takes three things. One is enablers. Two is to deal with the obstacles, and three are the metrics. In the enabling category, there are tools and there are energizers, and I think all of that maps to what you're saying. The one that I think jumps out at me is how, you know, is the energizer question, because that's always very key. You can start down the path, but can you sustain the path? Can you keep fueling the kinds of changes? How do we deal with that? How do we energize it?
I think there are a lot of people active and out there and energetic, and there are a lot of people very committed to their community. In this city of Atlanta, you have tens of thousands of people volunteering in community-based organizations, tens of thousands of people very active in the churches and youth programs. You have police who are active in prevention. You have doctors, you have nurses, you have the Atlanta Project. There's lots of things, lots of people, lots of groups that are energized. I think here's where science can help them keep the momentum up. What we can do is to help them look and see, of all the activities you're engaged in, which ones are making a difference, which ones work, and where to focus your efforts. The truth is, no one has enough time and effort to do everything. But as the momentum builds, if we can continuously improve the process and learn as we go, we can start to focus energy of people on those interventions that will make a difference. And seeing that they make a difference will build the momentum and will start to reinforce the people.
We talk about metrics. What you're saying is scorekeeping. How do you know you're winning? How do you know you're losing? What works mm-hmm. and what doesn't
And when
work?
When you begin to win, then you have the energy and enthusiasm to win some more, and then you can build on that good win, and then people can get excited, and then you can win some more rather than closing the doors and being depressed.
And you can make it a win-win situation. Yeah. Again, it gets back to this notion of teamwork. There don't have to be winners. There don't have to be losers. It can be win-win for all of us.
We will come back with a final thought from Dr. Mark Rosenberg from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in just a moment. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back. Dr. Mark Rosenberg is the director of National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. He's written a book, edited a book, called Violence in America, A Public Health Approach. The book is interesting. What you're saying is more interesting. We can do something about violence.
Violence is a public health problem, and I'd emphasize the word problem. I think that takes it out of the domain of thinking that violence is a fact of life or it's an aspect of life we're just saddled with. We are not. We can change it. We can prevent it. I think these three threads of the public health approach that focus on prevention, what can you do before it happens, is something that's been neglected. Applying science to this problem, tremendous potential for taking what we know about other public health problems. We've eradicated something like smallpox from the face of the earth. We don't have to eradicate violence, but it certainly gives us hope that this method can reduce it. And finally, the notion of teamwork, integrating what we learn from different disciplines, different parts of the community, different people, young and old, black and white. We can make such an incredible difference. Maybe the most amazing story is that we started out a very small voice addressing this issue. And last month in Geneva, Switzerland, 190 nations of the world voted to adopt a resolution that declared violence as a public health problem and urging the World Health Organization to start to apply a science-based public health approach.
And so you bring us hope and good news, and we're going to have to go out and work on that in our own ways, in our own individual lives and communities. Dr. Rosenberg, thank you for coming to be part of some answers to a problem we all face.
You're welcome. We'll work alone and we'll work together.
Thanks to Dr. Mark Rosenberg, director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at the Centers for Disease Control. We'll be there working with you. Thanks for being with us. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.